Good morning once again and welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. As the one-year anniversary of the arrest and death of Freddie Gray and the subsequent uprising approaches, we're beginning a special month-long series of interviews and discussions here on the Mark Steiner Show. Over the next 5 weeks, we'll offer an in-depth examination of the societal, historical conditions that created the Baltimore where Freddie Gray was born, where he was raised, where he died. The Baltimore marked by disinvested communities, over-police communities, and lack of economic opportunity. More than half of our fellow citizens are forced to exist in that kind of edge on poverty here in Baltimore. We'll examine policing, drug and housing policy, lead poisoning, discrimination against formerly incarcerated people, systemic racism, and the police and political realities of Baltimore. While we also search during this conversation over the month for alternative economic, social, and political models that allow us to have Baltimore become the healthy, beautiful place it can be for everybody who lives within our city. Today we begin our series by talking about policing, racial biases, Sandtown, the west side of Baltimore, a year after the uprising, a year after the death of Freddie Gray, as that approaches. And today is 48 years after the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King that led to the rebellion of 1968 that happened in the streets of Baltimore and in streets across this nation. In the second half of our hour, the last part of our program, in the first hour of the Mark Steiner Show today, we'll be talking with Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson about 1968, what Eddie was doing then in 1968 and his political reflections on what that means then and now. Right now we are joined by Ray Kelly, who is community organizer with the No Boundaries Coalition, and Tiffany Welch, director of health and food access for the No Boundaries Coalition. And Tiffany and Ray, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. But to do a call in if you can, 410-319-8888. We would love to hear from you and your reflections on this day when we remember the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King and what it meant for all of us and where our world is now. And Ray, let me start with you. Reflecting on the fact it's been 48 years since Reverend Dr. King was taken from us and assassinated, that led to the rebellions across the country, which were very different than – people try to make the comparison a lot between what happened in 68 and what happened in 2015. Well, they're very different circumstances and at times. I'm curious – how you view what has changed in Baltimore over these last years since the uprising began and Freddie Gray's death?
Well, I think it's important first to recognize that on this anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, to recognize the minimal progress made in Sandtown since those
68.
Riots. Since those riots, right. In 68, where properties that were destroyed in the 68 riots are still not there. The progress of a development or anything has not really happened in Sandtown. So the unrest and the riots of last year was pretty much the culmination of the frustrations of the community since the previous riots, where still, 50 years almost later, we have no progress. We have no voice. We don't have strong representation. We're being treated like we're still in pre-civil rights movement times. And in Sandtown, it's like it's the same. There hasn't been much change. There has been progress since last year's unrest, but really, we lost years of progress in just that 1 or 2 days.
And that's a very powerful statement to make. And Tiffany, let me let you jump in here. I was thinking, as you were speaking, about Sandtown, Winchester in 1962, 3, 4, 5, when I was a kid. And my best friend, Billy Bull, in life back then, grew up in Sandtown. So we spent a lot of time there because that was his old neighborhood. And then every time I go to Sandtown now, I walk through it, stop, see people, the difference, how it looks, how it feels. It's overwhelming to me still to try to kind of emotionally put my arms around.
And I'm that way where growing up there, growing up in the 70s, I got the end of the era where we could still go to the Carver on Sundays and watch karate flicks all day.
Right.
We still had
clothes
stores and things of that nature, and that's the change that needs to be addressed in Sandtown and on Pennsylvania Avenue in particular, where the perception when I was growing up, when you were seen on Pennsylvania Avenue, was you were shopping, you were getting fresh, it was something was happening, it was Easter.
Right.
And now the perception has totally changed, where if you're seen on Pennsylvania Avenue, the first assumption is you're buying drugs.
Tiffany, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I wasn't around in 1968. I wasn't born until 84.
Good for you.
And so I don't quite remember what happened in 68, but I did learn about it. And I think it's really sad that we even have to compare or measure the progress of what happened in 68 and compare it to the unrest in 2015. Riots are very dramatic events that happen and are supposed to be a wake-up call and are supposed to spark transformation. And the fact that we had it again, it's like, this dramatic event in 68 was done, and not only are the effects from the riots still very visible in Sandtown, but the mentality and some of the practices are still very visible as well to cause another unrest. And so years later, 40-some years later down the road from now, I don't want to see it happen again, so I'm glad that I'm a part of No Boundaries, and there are communities that were, I guess, catapulted to the forefront to make sure things like this don't happen again. But we've been on the ground, since 2012 when the boundaries started making way. And these things still are happening in the community, but to even have to measure something that happened before my time is really a shame for me, for as a millennial, and for people under me, for high schoolers that aren't quite understanding. They're thinking that this is something new, and I'm learning from my grandparents and parents that this is something that they've been fighting for, and I'm continuing the same fight in the same communities that they grew up in. It's really such a shame. And while we have made great measures, like Ray said, some of the pre-civil rights and civil rights mentalities are still there and in leadership positions and are in positions to make very critical decisions that are going to keep us in the same sort of boundary of not being able to progress in the ways we need to.
Well, let's talk about those boundaries. And one of the things in the report that you all put out, the over-policed yet underserved from the No Boundaries Coalition, it talked a lot about policing, obviously. And let's talk about what you think you've experienced, what the community's experienced since Freddie Gray's arrest and his death. How has the relationship between Sandtown and the police changed, the West Side changed in their relationship with the police and police relationship with it? With the community residents, you feel a difference, Ray, or is it things worse, the same? Where are they?
So, I've been in this, creating these conversations with the police departments for years. So, really, there's been multiple changes since the Freddie Gray's unrest, the riots, the Freddie Gray funeral, that we started and preemptively seeing this coming before Freddie Gray, where we had the protests and with as far back as actually the Trayvon Martin verdict. And there were conversations where it was bluntly stated, if it happens in Western District, they're going to burn it down. I mean, and that's a quote, where even then, where we're at the table and we're saying from the community, this is how we feel, it wasn't getting the proper attention preemptively. And then after the unrest, there was a time to quote the police command, the officers were disheartened. So we had no patrols. We had no kind of protection in Sandtown, Winchester. And we were pretty much told flat out that the officers are not going to respond. It's not going to happen right now. And then we saw all of the work from our previous years pretty much just disappear because of an influx where it doesn't take long for the word to spread. This is a good place to sell your product because there are no police. The police aren't going to come around here. They don't want phones.
So Tiffany, let me just jump in as well. I mean, I think one of the things that struck me about the No Boundaries report that you all put out, and I think I said this on the air when we first talked about the report, was beyond the issue of Freddie Gray's dying at the hands of the police because of what happened to him when he was taken into custody, the report just glares out talking about and the story after story of the physical and verbal abuse of citizens by police. At the same time, you're dealing with the drug slinging that Ray just talked about. So, I mean, all the contradictions there are. So, how have you seen it?
I've seen my feelings reflect the report. There are a lot of residents that are overwhelmingly in support of wanting better policing. But then you have a lot of residents, and some of those residents are within those families that I just talked about, who have had really traumatic experiences and don't really believe in the effectiveness of the police or even the willingness to trust the system. So from the beginning of any policing system where you're reporting something to the end of even welcoming police into your community to solve a crime, that whole system is flawed. So we have people on one end who are scared to interact with the police to report crimes. And then you have people on the other end who are neighbors and who don't want the police coming into the community to do what they're supposed to do, which is to serve and to protect. So from start to beginning, there's such a breakdown of how the community receives the police. Not only are people afraid of reporting, they're afraid of having the police in their community policing because there's such a disconnect between what used to be officer-friendly and who to go to and who the right officers are who actually protect your community and who is known to give a rough ride or who is known to harass somebody on the corner. It's a general breakdown of the overall policing strategy in the community. So you have elderly neighbors who are fearful now to contact the police, and you have well-to-do neighbors and business owners who are afraid to have come in and interview them at the same time. So I think once there is a strong relationship between all aspects of the police, not just the ones on the beat, ones in cars, the detectives, the higher-ups, do people feel like they're comfortable to actually walk into Western District and report something? Do people feel like it's going to be followed up on? All the questions that people in Sandton have to actually think about. And in other communities, you shouldn't have to ask yourself those questions when you're thinking about your law enforcement. Are you trusting the police to protect you and to provide you with the service that they're paid to do? That's not something you think about before you call 911 or something you have to think about before you go up to a police car. But in this community, there's an overall mistrust, a distrust. And through No Boundaries and Ray's work, we're trying to break that distrust. We're really trying to have residents talk to the police officers through community mediation, getting police visibility, getting the beats back. So that trust is there. Once the trust is broken down, then all processes of working with the police department breaks down. Like I said, from the reporting to the receiving them in the community to the outreach, every part is broken down. And those are all the factions that make up a strong police force, especially for the Western District. They're not located outside of our neighborhoods. They're located right in the middle of where the houses are, right in the block. So there has to be an overwhelming acceptance of them. But if there's deception and mistrust, then it's not going to work, and it's going to be an overall breakdown. And with us being so close to Central District, Western and Central are literally lines and miles apart from each other. We don't want to see over-policing in one area, under-policing in the other area, and people feeling like, oh, that side of the street or that part of the community receives fair treatment than our side of the community, and then we'll just have what we saw last April again shortly.
So, folks, I want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. I want to hear your thoughts and reflections on this. This is April, and last April, and just on April the 5th, 6th is when we saw what happened to Freddie Gray when he was arrested. A short while later, in 2 weeks, he passed away in the hospital. Your thoughts about where we've seen these conversations about policing in Baltimore take place? Have things changed? If they haven't, why do you think they have not? What do you think ought to be done? 410-319-8888. So the question is, how do you change this? When you have like a reflection here from one of the people in your report with you that you interviewed No Boundaries. This, by the way, folks, we're going to connect to on the web, put out in March 2016. We did a program about it. Over-policed yet underserved, the people's findings regarding police misconduct in West Baltimore is an amazingly thorough and powerful report that I recommend everybody really take their time to look at. It's a centerpiece for organizing and thinking about where we go next. But somebody said to you all, by the time we were teenagers, we didn't trust the police at all. And when the crack epidemic descended on Baltimore and the so-called war on drugs was declared, with street sweeping and military tactics, it shifted to us against them. When things became violent in our community, we were all suspects and treated as such. It was nothing to be stopped and searched by the police. As a young black man in a high-crime area, it was actually routine. Another person wrote saying to you, another was quoted saying, I asked my granddaughter, do Officer Friendly come in y'all school? She said, what's that, Ma? And all I could say was, Lord have mercy. So tell me what you think is, how does this change, Ray?
And for one, we have to, as Tiffany spoke on, the trust issue is so embedded where the police have to kind of leverage that authority with people that residents trust already. And it has to start with humanizing each other. It has to start with these community mediation type endeavors where we have to actually plant these post offices back in the community, and the department has to be committed to keeping them there. Where, for one, that's a big issue in what Western District is the officer turnover, where every day there's a new officer, and because it's tactical, that trust is automatic right there. There has to be a process of speaking on these very issues. And one, the first thing that has to happen is they have to pass 1026 today so we could have civilian oversight, because really the community feels that the police can do whatever they want, whenever they want, wherever they want in our community, because there's no accountability. There's no fear of consequence.
Let me open the phones, get a couple calls in here while we have our two friends here from No Boundaries with us in the studio. 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning, Hank.
My issue is this, right? Our city does not allow us to get jobs. They allow people to come in without doing such big tax breaks, where the jobs are actually economical for us, right? The most beautiful thing any man could ever hear come out of another man's mouth is, I'll see y'all later. I got to get up and go to work in the morning. That makes that man's child look up to him and respect him and emulate him. Now, I only know this because my kids emulate me, right? My kids get up and go get jobs, right? And it's because I've worked all my life to show them that a job is a necessary way to go. So that don't mean I ain't break law. That don't mean they didn't break law. They just meant that when I caught them blowing law, I showed them my ways, and I showed them how I survived, right? I once heard my son tell somebody, I don't need a high school diploma because my father owns his own business, and he doesn't have one. I went to school every day, out of the GED class, every 3 days with my son, just to make sure he got his GED. But my child now works at Hard Rock Cafe and Cordova. My oldest boy works at Pepsi. My biological oldest son works at FedEx. My daughter works at the Sedan Cup.
Okay.
Because they see me working. If we ain't providing no jobs, then we just let them run it straight. We ain't giving them nothing.
Hank, I always appreciate your thoughts. I really do. And I'm going to let Tiffany jump in and kind of respond a little bit to what you heard Hank say. Tiffany?
I wish we had more Hanks in the community. It's a lot of people who have children. The 80s affected a lot of parents. And we have teens that are parents of 80s and early 90s babies. And some don't get to enforce that to their children, to go to work, to get your GED, to do those things that we know will make them successful. So we have kids out there that are lost, that don't have parents, that are being raised by grandparents. And that's why it's crucial for us to have these opportunities to employ the youth, to have opportunities for them to develop their vocational skills, their educational skills, their essential skills, to get the job. A lot of these kids that are on these corners aren't on there just because they thought of going on there. They're second-generation drug dealers. They are third-generation drug dealers because the institutions, the opportunities have not been in the community, and that's what we're trying to bring back. We're trying to bring more youth employment, more job skills, more opportunities for ex-offenders to be employed, because this isn't a new problem. Like we were talking about 68, these problems have been in Baltimore, And they've come and they've gone. There have been some solutions. They haven't been consistent, and they've been very absent from the community. So I love that Hank is telling his children to do these things so they'll have successful lives. But everyone doesn't have a Hank. And for those who don't have a Hank, we need to have these programs that are gonna be mentors to these youngsters. They're going to give them opportunities to make different choices than maybe their parents have made.
And I think, again, another quote from this from your piece here, and before we turn back to Ray and get a phone call from Ray. One witness, Mr. R, had previously filed a formal complaint against an officer who harassed her son. She was later arrested by the same officer in her neighborhood for dropping a candy wrapper on the ground.
And that's that disrespect where for years officers have been able to operate with impunity pretty much. What can you say when you've been arrested for whatever and they take you to central booking and you've spent 15, 25 hours there and you let go and nothing comes of it? You have a civilian review board that has no power. What can you do?
So let me ask you, too, before we run out of time in this short segment, we're going to come back a much longer conversation with you all and spend some time down in Sandtown to really get the stories out here for people to hear. What are the solutions? I mean, what do we do to change the nature of policing and relations between police and this community? I mean, we have like 3.5 minutes here, so let me just get your thoughts on that really fast.
Well, I believe in a community policing model, but working in this field for years, I know that a community policing model can only be a tactic going towards a solution because the safest communities don't need policing. Patrol every now and again is fine, but we need to work on getting a community that doesn't need military-style tactics and those type of it has to be a community collaborative. With all these, the health issue has to be addressed. We have to address this whole job issue that Hank talked about, where opportunities have fleeted from our communities, where we need that type of manufacturing and thing, and we need to create opportunities that are geared towards our populace. Like you said, returning citizens need opportunities or they fall into the same cycle.
Tiffany?
We need trust. We need police visibility and effective police visibility. When residents can stop being fearful that they'll be they'll be locked up for dropping a candy wrapper when they have to walk through open-air drug markets to get to the corner store, the grocery store, that's when it'll be a better relationship between the police. It has to be effective, visible policing. We don't want to see the police in their cars and then see 20, 30 people on the corner selling drugs while you have somebody getting harassed for dropping a candy wrapper. When it becomes visible and effective, the trust will be brought back, and then we'll bring back the vibrancy that we once had to places like Pennsylvania Avenue. We'll bring back the merchants. We'll bring back homeowners. But until we see actually policing working, the mistrust will still be there.
This report's so chock full of things. I want people to feel and hear them who haven't heard them, and then we can make some more comments here. Witness observed police officer robbing a drug dealer and stating, "My kids are going to have a good Christmas this year." Witness observed an officer pat down a boy on the corner of Strickland Pressman, apparently looking for drugs. The officer then took the boy's money from his pocket, told him to get the F off this corner. Witness son sitting in his car in front of the house. Officers pulled up and told him to get the F out of the car. Officers told the son he was being searched because it was illegal to be sitting in a car without a seatbelt on because the car was running.
And that happens. It's unbelievable to people outside of our community. But when your community has been allowed to become this front line for the war on drugs, for lack of a better statement, this is what happens. So not only does it happen to the 10% of the community or less that are actually breaking the law or selling drugs or involved in illegal activity, it happens to all of us. And because of the prevalence of profiling and things of that nature, you can't tell me from a drug dealer on a snowy day when we're bundled up. And anybody that's in the community is subject to this type of treatment.
Raleigh Hayes tweeted in, @MarkSteiner, Has anything changed in the past year regarding policing in our communities? No.
And I can't disagree. Where it's definitely a slow process, and there has been progress. There hasn't been a lot of change, but there is a consistent conversation now happening between residents and Western District Patrol officers through community mediation. The commissioner did actually initiate foot patrols on Pennsylvania Avenue where they last Saturday that you could actually see that difference. And always our issue is you do this for the media, for the publicity, but it's not being sustained. So he's exactly right. Pretty much we're where we were maybe in 2012. In 2014, Western District recorded our lowest number of homicides in 12 years, I believe, with 21, and that was with collaboration, all of the different visibility efforts. And
Tiffany, I think we have to take a break here, but it does take that collaboration.
Yeah, it takes the collaboration, but I agree with the feeder, and the answer is no, it's not consistent. We have peaks of visibility, and then it goes away. And I don't know if that's on the heels of media or whatever attention there is, but it's not consistent, and it needs to be in order to really have an effective police force.
We're going to come back to both these guests in the coming weeks and talk a great deal more. I think that what No Boundaries Coalition is doing is incredibly important work, uniting communities throughout the West Side to stand up and make a change. And I want to invite all of you on the 13th of this month to join me and Eddie Conway at the Douglas Memorial Church with Neighbors United as we do a forum with mayoral candidates, specifically with returning citizens and how to change these communities, and ask some very pointed questions. I hope you'll all join us there at Douglas Memorial at 6 p.m. on the 13th. I want to thank Tiffany Welch, Director of Health and Food Access for No Boundaries Coalition, Ray Kelly, Community Organizer with No Boundaries, for the work you're doing, some of the most important work in the city, I think, and I look forward to having you all on a great deal more and putting No Boundaries out there so we can have these conversations on the radio with all of you for longer time. So thank you both so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
We're getting a brief break. When we come back, we hear what Eddie Conway and Dominic Stevenson think.